Good morning. It's good to see so many people out this morning. I want to welcome our visitors. We are glad to see so many of you and that you have chosen to be with us this morning. Last week, for those that were with us, we started a series on baptism. We'll pick up with that series in part two next Sunday morning. Today is the third Sunday of the month, which is our song and scripture service in the evening. But this morning, we're going to be continuing our Godly Women series. And it's part seven. And this is Esther. I have it titled, For Such a Time as This. For many of you might remember when we had you rank them in the order you would like to hear them, Esther was ranked number one. Chronologically, she falls number seven, and that's why we're talking about her now. But for those that voted for her, this is the moment. I want to make a couple disclaimers before we get going. In a book as long as this, there's 10 chapters. The 10th chapter is really short, just a few verses really. So 9 longer chapters. I want to remind you of what I did when we talked about Ruth. This is not designed to be a book study. There's a lot of details that we're not going to be able to get to. There's even a lot of information I've put together, and I'm excited to share with you my study from the last few weeks as we get going. But we're not going to be able to get into everything because of the length of the book and the time that we have to present it. So, the outline and PowerPoint are on the website already. And I want to, if you have already checked that out, I want to direct your attention to the last page of the outline. There's a page called Additional Notes. There are a lot of things on there from my research and study that we're just not going to get to cover. One of those I do want to cover towards the end of the lesson if we have enough time. But there is a lot of good information there, and there's a lot of passages and details that we're just not going to be able to get to. And in fact, there's a lot on my PowerPoint that Becky doesn't think I'm going to get to either. So, but it'll be up there, and if we go too fast on it, I do encourage you to download it from the website and look over it then. But as I pointed out, this point of the study of Esther is to look at her and her character. And so a lot of the story is going to come out because she plays an integral part to the central plot of the book. But this is not a book study. The book is arranged in several different ways. It's got a lot of doubles. It's got a lot of ironies. It's a very fascinating book. And some of those things as they relate to Esther will point out as we go through it. But one of the reasons we wanted to do a study on godly women is that in the scriptures, there are examples both good and bad of both men and women. And that men and women alike can provide us with sources of strength and inspiration. And this is a list of the women we've looked at so far in our series going back to January. We looked at Eve and then Sarah and Ruth, Abigail, the Proverbs 31 woman that was an ideal, and the Shunammite woman as we looked at last month. All of these remind us that godly role models are greatly needed today. The book of Esther, for those that read it from cover to cover, from chapter 1, verse 1, all the way to the end, and we're not going to be able to do that today. I remember long ago, a preacher got up and said, we're going to talk about Esther today. And we all thought he was joking when he says, turn to Esther chapter 1, verse 1, and began reading. And no, he read through the whole book. We don't have time to do that this morning. So we're going to be looking at Esther in a lot of summaries. We're going to summarize a lot, and that's why the outline is on the website for you to get later and be able to look at. But the book of Esther reads like an action story, or I put in our day and time, it would read like a movie. It has intrigue, suspense, betrayal, conspiracy, treachery, romance, murder, jealousy, and anger. All these different things that Hollywood writers love to put into a story, all wrapped in one as the perfect companion story perfect story of some kind. Esther has all of that, and Esther is the central character, but the plot of the book centers on Mordecai's refusal to bow to Haman, the king's second in command, and then Haman, seeking revenge on all the Jews, vows to wipe them all out, not just Mordecai, but wipe them all out. Reminds you of, if you're familiar with the Star Wars franchise, the emperor saying, wipe them out, all of them. That was Haman. Haman did it before the emperor did. Haman's attitude was, let's wipe them out. And in a lot of ways, and there's very subtle clues, and I'll try to point them out as we go, but this looks like one of the last recorded incidents of Israel versus the Amalekites, a story long in the making going all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 15. But let's get into it. Esther chapters 1 and 2. In Esther chapter 1, about 50 years after King Cyrus released the Jews from captivity, for those that keep a date in history, that was about 536 BC. This is the reign of Ahasuerus. That's his Persian name, who was Xerxes I. That's his Greek name. And he reigned from 486 to 465 BC. He was son of Darius the Great. There's a lot of historians that have a lot of information to tell us about who his father was and his accomplishments and how he tried to follow in his father's footsteps. And in a lot of ways, he did what his father could not do. He threw a huge drunken party that lasted 180 days. What do you think about that? That's 6 months. Could you call into work and ask for 6 months off for a celebration? I want to go on holiday for 6 months. Well, the king did, and he had all his princes and his nobles and his royals. They threw a drunken party that lasted 180 days. As we read through the text, it tells us wine flowed freely. Everyone was given whatever they wished. And on the seventh day, he called for Queen Vashti to come be displayed, which she refused. And because this is not a book study, we don't have a lot of time to talk about that incident. But that incident sets up about 4 or 5 years later of what's going to happen when Esther is in the picture. Out of fear that her refusal to come before the king would embolden women throughout the realm to disobey their husbands, she was removed from being queen, and a decree went out stating men were in charge of the homes. Now, for a pagan country, this really was a godly principle. It just happened in a weird, bizarre way. And then we come to chapter 2, where a massive beauty contest was enacted to find the next queen. For those who might remember the early 2000s, there was a reality show came out, a couple seasons, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire? Well, if this was a reality show, they could have titled it Who Wants to Marry a King? And they gathered all the hopefuls from across the land. The difference between this and the reality shows of today is the contestants here didn't have a choice. They were gathered by force, by edict or decree of the king, and they were gathered to him. All the virgins from around the realm were taken by force to the king's harem in Susa, and there Esther is introduced to us in Esther 2, 5-7. We're actually going to read that, Esther chapter 2, 5-7. So if you have your Bibles open, go ahead and turn there. As I said, we're going to do a lot of summarizing, but on a few occasions we're going to actually read several passages from Esther that give us an indication of what's happening. So in Esther 2, 5-7, we're introduced to her. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. This gives us his lineage and provides one of those clues to find out how this is that last recorded battle between Israelites and Amalekites. So verse 6, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah. We talked about him this morning in our adult Bible class. That year of his captivity dates to about 597 BC, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. The interesting thing is Esther, the central character here, is given her Hebrew name Hadassah, which means myrtle, and her Persian name, which means star, or if it comes from Ishtar, it means morning star. Ishtar was a Persian goddess, a Babylonian goddess that the Persians also adopted. But she was a virgin and she was beautiful in form, that means figure or body, and face. So it's telling us she was very lovely to look at. And then Mordecai, that's a Persian name for the Babylonian god Marduk. The interesting thing is his Hebrew name is not given. It only tells us what he's known by his Babylonian name, Marduk. He was a Benjamite, a descendant of those taken in captivity with King Jehoiakim. He's a cousin to Esther and raised her as his own daughter. And Esther is an example of loyalty, trusting in God, and doing what is required to serve him. And that's hopefully what's going to play out as we look through the book of Esther and how Esther played a role in saving God's people, fulfilling his promises that there would be a Messiah from the tribe of Judah. Always keep that in the back of your mind, that the big, big picture is that God's promises are sure. Even though this book has a unique feature that God is nowhere mentioned throughout the whole book, his providential care for his people and keeping his promises are there throughout. He promised through Jeremiah and others, especially Jeremiah, that once the exiles returned, that he was going to shield them. He was going to see good for them and not evil. And because he promised that his suffering servant through Isaiah 52 and 53 would come about, God's promises are sure and steadfast. And Esther is going to play a role in protecting those promises that she doesn't even know about. In Esther chapter 2, 1-18, the young virgins are gathered from the kingdom, were brought to Susa. They were placed in the care of a eunuch named Hegai. He was the king's chamberlain. He was said he was the keeper of the women, and he gave them all their rites of purification. Esther was a virgin. She was found and was brought to Susa. I want to mention just a couple things about her as we look at her in three phases. We're going to look at her as a humble virgin, a brave queen, and a clever hostess. As we talk about her as a humble virgin, it's interesting to note that she never pushed herself forward to seek the crown of Vashti. She never pushed herself forward and said, "Marry me, I'll do a better job." She was a victim of the circumstances that she was gathered from the rest of the kingdom and brought to Susa. They were all given, all these virgins were given special privileges and allowed all that they demanded. But it's interesting about the humility of Esther. She only asked for what Hegai thought she should have. So she asked for advice of the eunuch who was in charge of all these women, asked him what he thought would be best, and that's all that she asked for. You can imagine, and it's not really said, but you can imagine when it tells us that they were given anything that they demanded, what some of the other women might have taken advantage of this situation for, but not Esther. She was humble, and she only asked of what Hegai thought she should have. And in this way, she won not only his favor, but we're told in these passages, the favor of all who looked upon her. And in fact, in verses 16 to 18, we're going to read this a little later on. She found favor with the king, and he made her his queen. In Esther 2, 19 to 20, we read that she was an obedient daughter. Remember, Mordecai raises her as his own. When she was taken for the beauty contest, in verse 10, he advised her not to reveal her Jewish heritage. And here is what begins something that's in contrast to Daniel and his three friends. In Daniel chapter 1, we read that Daniel and his three friends were some of the youths gathered from the nobility of Israel. They were possibly even royal princes among that school. They were going to be put in a school for 3 years. Daniel didn't want to eat the food from the king's table that they were offered or drink his wine because it wasn't going to be according to their dietary standards. And so we're told in Daniel chapter 1 verse 8 that he made up his mind not to defile himself with the king's food. A plan was put in place that he and his three friends for that 3 years were able to eat nothing but vegetables, and they succeeded. They prospered. God was with them. We don't read that Esther followed the Jewish dietary laws. One of the reasons for that is because she's hiding her heritage. So she's going to be eating from the king's table with everyone else. Esther did, in verse 20, Esther did what Mordecai told her as she had done when under his care. She was obedient to Mordecai as in the king's harem as well as she was under his own roof. She did not disobey Mordecai. In that, she was an obedient daughter. And from humble means, she became Queen Esther. Esther chapter 2, 16 to 17 says, "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." The book of Esther has many parallels to the account of Joseph in Genesis chapters 41 through 46. One of the big things that we read here is God has plans for our lives. And often we are placed where we need to be at that particular time. She would not have been there if she had not found favor, or if she was not a virgin, and if she was not humble. She was placed there at the right time for the right reasons. And because she was a virgin, because she was humble, she found favor with all of those that came in contact with her, including the king. He fell in love with her and made her his queen. And we see that she was a faithful wife. In Esther 2, 21 to 23, we read this. "In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So this seemingly short account comes into massive play later on in Esther chapter 6. But Mordecai, it looks to the king, he uncovers a plot to kill the king. He tells Esther. Esther informs the king in the name of Mordecai, so she gives him the credit. She didn't have to do that. She didn't even have to inform the king. If she didn't really love him, if she felt like now's my chance to be rid of him, she could have just let him die. But she was a faithful wife. And she was faithful still to Mordecai, her mentor or father figure. She gave him the credit. The two are responsible, are hanged, and Mordecai's actions are recorded in the king's annals. And though she gave Mordecai the credit for the plot discovery, we see she was faithful to save her husband. She was that faithful wife. And then we talk about her as a brave queen. In Esther chapter 3, this takes place after 4 years. We can know this from Esther chapter 2, 16 to 17, and then balancing that against Esther 3 in verse 7. Haman, in verse 1, is made the king's favorite. Haman was an Agagite, a descendant of the kings of the Amalekites. Agag became a royal title. The Lord had declared perpetual war against Amalek. If you look in Exodus chapter 7 and verse 16, 17 verse 16, God says there is perpetual war against Amalek. And in 1 Samuel chapter 15, King Saul and his army are charged with the absolute destruction of the Amalekites. They are to kill everybody. Even the animals. But remember, Saul brings back Agag the king and choice spoils. And when Samuel asks him, why does he hear the bleating of the goats when he says, I've obeyed the voice of God, he says, oh, well, the people want to keep some of the spoils and we're going to sacrifice them to your God. Oh, and look, I brought the king. And Samuel had to put the king to death himself. So an Agagite means he is one of the royal line descendants from that king Agag from 1 Samuel 15. The book of Esther relates the last recorded battle of that war, telling us there's far-reaching consequences from Saul's disobedience. And we're introduced to Mordecai. He refuses to give him the honor he demands in chapter 3, 2 through 4. He will not bow to him. It's interesting, in chapter 5, verse 9, he won't rise. He won't bow in chapter 3. He wouldn't rise in Haman's presence in chapter 5, verse 9. Persian law allowed for kings and high-ranking officials to be bowed to not only as reverence for the office, but also worshipped as a god. It's likely that Haman demanded this type of subjection, and knowing everything we're going to see about Haman, his character. And that's probably why Mordecai wouldn't give him that satisfaction. He wouldn't give him that honor. But I've noticed a lot of commentaries and books and footnotes in Bibles want to tell us that he didn't bow because he was a Jew. And I just want to point out that that's not feasible. The Jews were never forbade to bow in honor or respect to people of authority. We're not going to go through this. We don't have time. This is 10 select passages that's on the outline on the website, designed to show just 10 cases where Jews bowed to one another. They bowed to kings, to princes, to the king's son-in-law, even to prophets and the queen mother. Jews were not forbade not to bow out of respect and honor. In all these different cases, we see kings, we see prophets, we see priests, or not priests, we see princes and the king's son-in-law being bowed to, even the queen mother in the form of Bathsheba, being shown respect and honor through bowing. So I encourage you to look through that on your own. I just want to show this is just a small sampling of the passages we can get of Jews bowing to someone else both before the law of Moses and after. So it doesn't make any sense to say he wouldn't bow because he was a Jew. It makes more sense that it's probably because either he wanted that deification bow, or some of the subtle clues are that he is a Benjamite and Haman is an Amalekite. Whatever the case here, Mordecai would not bow to him. Some suggest that because he's of the tribe of Benjamin, that is the tribe of King Saul who fought the Amalekites and charged with their complete destruction, 1 Samuel 15, and that here he refuses to bow to an Amalekite. We don't really know with 100% surety why he didn't bow, and it's not really important. The point is, Haman's pride was hurt. And because of that, Haman vows vengeance on all the Jews in chapter 3, verses 5 to 6. He, upon a malicious suggestion from his family, obtains an order from the king to have all the Jews massacred on a certain day. And chapter 3, 7 to 13. And the funny thing is, in verse 8, it comes back into play later, he subtly omits the name of the people that are the king's enemies that he needs to wipe out. But the king lets him do it anyway. And this is another attempt by Satan to cut off the people of God, to stop the seed that would crush his head, going back to Genesis 3:15. This order is dispersed throughout the kingdom, chapter 3, 14 to 15. And then we're told that King and Haman, King Ahasuerus or Xerxes, and Haman drink while the city is thrown into confusion, Jew and non-Jew alike, as this order is dispersed throughout the city. So then Esther chapter 4, 1 to 9. Mordecai learns of the plan. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. He wailed and wept loudly. Esther finds out. She sends messengers to find out why. And she hears what Haman has planned. And she finds out Mordecai wants her to talk to the king. And here we're going to read Esther 4, 11 to 14. One of those passages that is kind of the crux of the whole book. In Esther chapter 4, 11 to 14. Esther reminds Mordecai of Persian law, that anyone that goes to the king unsummoned will be put to death unless he holds out his golden scepter. And she's going to remind Mordecai she's not been summoned for 30 days. So, read with me Esther 4, starting in verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter that he may live. And I've not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." Other versions read, "Who knows if you've not come into the kingdom for such a time as this." Even without mentioning God, can you see his deep faith? God promised that the Jews would prosper when they returned to the land from exile, and that as suffering servant, the Messiah, the anointed one of God, would come and establish his kingdom. He would be a king and a priest, as so many other passages mention, as some of those we looked at this morning in the adult Bible class. Mordecai has complete faith in God, that God's not going to allow this to happen. And if Esther doesn't act, deliverance will come from somewhere else. And he says, "Perhaps you've been here for such a time as this." In Jeremiah 24, 6 to 7, God said he would build them up and not overthrow them after the exiles returned. Similar conclusion that Joseph came to in Genesis 45, 5 to 7. Where he tells his brothers, while they meant it for evil, God meant it for good. God sent him to Egypt to save many lives, especially his family. They didn't see the big picture, but God sees it and is in control of it all. In Esther 4, 15 to 17. Esther 4, 15 to 17. Esther told Mordecai she would go after 3 days of fasting. She told them to fast, which often included praying. And she said to do this for her for 3 days. She said, "I will go in to the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." She says, "I'm going to do it. If I die, I die." You know, that reminds me of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When they told Nebuchadnezzar they would not bow the knee to his golden idol. And he said, "Don't you know what I've done? I've got a fiery furnace ready." And because of their words, he heated up 7 times. And they said, "We will not bow. If we die, we die." God can deliver us, and if he chooses not to, know this, we will not bow. Esther's got that same spirit. If I die, I die, because I'm doing something not according to the law. There's a lesson here for us when making big decisions, not to leave God out. Notice this isn't something she just rushes into. She prays, she fasts, she asks them to do so for 3 days. James chapter 4, 15 tells us we need to have God on our mind as we make these big plans. Lest we say tomorrow or next year, I'm going to do this and that. Make sure we say as long as it's in God's will. In Esther 5, 1 to 4, we're going to read this passage. This is the defining moment. This is that for such a time as this moment. Esther braved the law, and she entered the king's throne room. She finds favor and touches his outstretched scepter. Esther 5:1-4, "Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, 'What is troubling you, Queen Esther?' He knew something was bothering her. Remember Persian law? You don't do this unless it's extremely important, because you take your life in your own hands. And the queen just did that. He says, 'What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even the half of the kingdom it shall be given to you.'" It tells us the great honor, the respect, and the love he had for this woman. Esther said, "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I've prepared for him." Oh, what an honor. You can only imagine, and we don't have to imagine too much. If you go and read through that, you'll see Haman was on cloud nine. He was invited to a banquet. The queen braved Persian law, took her life in her own hands to invite the king and just Haman to a banquet. Oh, what a guy. What a wonderful guy. That's what he thought in his own mind. Even if dangerous, we must be ready to do the work God has called us to do. That was Esther's spirit. No matter what it took, if I die, I die. She was going to do her part. And that leads us to the last part. We're going to talk about Esther as a clever hostess. In Esther 5:4-14, at the banquet, Esther requested the king and Haman attend another banquet the next day. Oh, we're told just how puffed up with pride Haman was. In verse 11, Haman gathers his friends and family, and it says he recounted the glory of his riches, the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. "Gather together, my friends, as I tell you the tale of me." That's what's happening here. Haman's saying, "Gather around, friends and family. I have a great story to tell you, and it's all about me. Look how many times I have made favor with the king. And now I've had a banquet with the king and queen. And now I've been invited by special request by the queen again tomorrow." But then we read that on cloud nine, as he's going home, he sees Mordecai the Jew in verse 9. And Mordecai, not only would he not bow in chapter 3, but here he would not rise in his presence. And now, after all of this, he be at seeing Mordecai, the Jew, sitting in his presence. He becomes depressed. He becomes angry. And so he listened to his wife and friends, and he built a gallows 75 feet high, that's 50 cubits, to hang Mordecai on. You don't need a gallows that high to kill a person. This was for public spectacle. This was to show everybody, this is what happens to the person that does not bow to me or rise in my presence. This is what happens to those that do not honor me. And here's the irony. He cannot wait to gain permission from the king. And so he's going to come to the king early in the morning, if not in the middle of the night, to gain permission. He can't sleep. Well, we're told in Esther chapter 6, the king can't sleep either. The night of that first banquet, the king couldn't sleep. For whatever reason, his sleep is evading him. And so he does what anyone does. Remember, Haman says, "Let's read the story of me." The king says, "Let's read the story of me as it's recorded in the king's annals." And he has someone else read the story of me and my greatness and my kingdom. And this works out because he finds out that as the scribe is going through, that he never rewarded Mordecai for saving his life. So the scribe gets to that part where the assassination attempt several years before was found out, and that Mordecai had the credit for the saving. And he finds out, "Did we ever honor this guy? Did we ever reward this guy?" And the scribe says, "No, my king, we never did." At that moment, he hears a noise in the courtyard. And he says, "Tell me who's in the courtyard." And they said, "It's Haman." Right at that moment, you talk about timing. You can't make this stuff up. Haman's right there in the courtyard as the king saying, "I never rewarded Mordecai the Jew." And so he says, "Bring Haman in." So Haman comes in. Haman's there to get vengeance on someone that did not honor him. Well, the king can't sleep because he just found out he never honored the guy that saved his life. So he asked Haman, what should he do for the one he wants to honor? And here's the irony. The king omits the name of the man as Haman left out the name of the certain people who were a threat to the kingdom in chapter 3, verse 8. The king doesn't tell him who the man he wants to honor is, but who else would it be? Haman's number two. He had special invite the night before to a banquet, and he's going that next day by special request of the queen. Who else would it be? So, Haman, he must have given some good thought to this, because look what he comes up with. Haman says, for the man to wear one of the king's robes, ride the king's horse while wearing a royal crown, be led through the streets by one of the king's princes, publicly declaring that this is how the king honors whom he desires to honor. There's a lot of irony here. He wanted to hang someone on that 75-foot gallows to say, this is what happens to the man that does not honor me. While he says to the king, you do this, this declares to everyone what the king will do to the one that he wants to honor. It says it sounded good to the king, and he promptly ordered Haman to do all that he suggested to Mordecai the Jew. There's a lesson here from Mordecai. Sometimes we're not rewarded immediately for the good things that we do in life. And we're not to be discouraged of that. We're to keep doing what we need to do. Because the reward is always that much greater when it's in God's time. Because God does not forget. The irony here is Haman went to the king to hang Mordecai and ends up personally honoring him for the king. Can you imagine asking the king now to hang this guy on a 75-foot gallows? Haman's sunk and he knows it. His family knows it. When he goes home, his family is going to say, oh, he's a Jew? Oh, you're done. That's what his family is going to tell him. After all their bluster of build it 75 feet high, they're going to say, oh, he's a Jew? And you just did that? Yeah, you're done. You're not going to win this. So Esther chapter 7. At the second banquet, Esther reveals she's a Jew and that Haman has plotted to annihilate her people, jeopardizing her life. In fact, she says in verse 6, when the king says, who has done this? She says, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Some versions say this vile Haman. The king angrily leaves the room and Haman falls upon her couch begging her for his life. The king comes back in from the garden, thinks that he's assaulting the queen in his own home in verses 7 to 8. And at that moment, his face is covered. And they say, oh, by the way, he had a gallows built for Mordecai, 75 feet high. The king says, hang him on it. And now the public spectacle is Haman. This is what happens to those who threaten the life of the queen and her people. Oh, what the irony that is displayed here in this book. Later in chapter 9, verse 14, Haman's 10 sons were also hanged on that gallows. When God calls you to use your gift for His glory, don't hesitate to risk everything for God. That was the spirit that Esther had. To risk it all. She says, if I die, I die. But she was clever about how she went about it. And it all worked out perfectly in God's time, as it always does. To summarize the next two chapters, 8 and 9, the king's order can't be reversed. We know this from reading Daniel chapter 6 and verse 8. When the satraps against Daniel trick the king into signing into a bill that no one can pray to anyone but the king for 30 days, risking the lion's den. That Persian law stated once it was signed by the king, it could not be reversed. We're introduced to that same law again here. When she asked the king to save her people, he says, what I've signed, I signed. I can't do it. Well, he signs a new law. This one says the Jews can fight back without repercussion. They can fight back on that particular day to defend life and property. 2 months and 10 days after Haman's edict was signed, in Esther 3, 10 to 13, the new law is signed. So, I mean, Haman's fall was quick. He was promoted as the second in command 2 months and 10 days after he had tricked the king into signing it. Mordecai is given Haman's office and his estate. Chapter 8, 1 to 2, it says, all his riches that he boasted in were given to Mordecai the Jew. It is a complete success. The enemies of God's people are routed and killed 8 months and 20 days later, Esther chapter 9, verse 1. 500 men killed in Susa, including Haman's 10 sons, and 75,000 men killed throughout the provinces. The battle between Benjamin or Israel and the Amalekites is over. Israel is the victor. And now they enjoy rest from their enemies. And so Mordecai and Esther, because of the 2 days of fighting, the king extended the day of fighting to another day, so it was actually 2 days. They established the Feast of Purim to commemorate the salvation of the Jews on the 14th and 15th of Adar, which translates to about March 14th and 15th. Purim is from Pur, that is to cast lots. That's how Haman determined the day that he would annihilate the Jews. He cast lots. He left it to chance, going back to chapter 3 and verse 7. I know I'm a little bit long on time, but I wanted to read one of these things from my additional notes concerning Purim. I found it an interesting part of my research that this stretched into the 1930s and 40s under Hitler's regime. I just want to read this. It says, Hitler made a connection to his regime to Haman and outlawed Purim in Germany. For many years on Purim, he would hang, shoot, or similarly execute 10 Jews out of vengeance for the hanging of Haman's 10 sons. He also outlawed the Book of Esther, and anyone found to possess a copy were executed. I just found that interesting. That's a part of history of World War II I didn't know, that he would take vengeance on Haman's 10 sons. In Esther 10, Mordecai is given Haman's old position, second only to the king, in chapter 10 and verse 3. And something else that's very interesting is a Babylonian cuneiform tablet from Borsippa near Babylon mentions a scribe by the name of Mardukai, which translates to Mordecai, saying he was a minister or accountant to Xerxes I at his palace in Susa. And so here's a historical mention of Mordecai, which makes sense. We read in chapter 10, verse 3, he was elevated to the second position below the king. The providence of God can be seen clearly throughout this book, despite his name never being mentioned. You can also see the account of Joseph, who recognized it was the hand of God in Genesis 50 and verse 20. When things seemed bleak, seemed like the promise of God was going to fall all apart. The enemies of God were going to descend and just wipe out the Jews, not only in the Persian provinces, but all the provinces. That included Jerusalem. But in Esther 6, small incidents from the earlier narrative come to play an important role in the reversal of fortunes for Haman. All the way from the king unable to sleep, to calling for his annals to be read, Haman showing up just at the right time in the courtyard, to being given the task to honor Mordecai. The hand of God was in control over all the evidence, all the events, and it's evident from that. And before we close, I want to mention some further lessons from Esther. Remember that no matter what, no matter how bad it seems, God is in control. He was putting the right people in where they needed to be to accomplish His will of saving His people. His promises will not fail. Never forget who you are. She could have kept it hidden. She could have banked on the fact that the king wasn't going to allow anything to happen to her. He didn't know she was a Jew by her looks. She could have kept it hidden, but she didn't. She revealed herself to him at the right moment. In Romans 8:15-17, we're told we're the children of the king. We are brought into his household by adoption. We can cry out to him as Jesus did, Abba, Father. God's promises are trustworthy. No matter how bleak it seems, remember God's promises. He promised a Messiah from the tribe of Judah and David's family, 2 Samuel 7:14. Luke chapter 1, 32 and 33 said that would be fulfilled in Jesus, because God kept his promise and his people were delivered. When the time comes, as Esther, we need to be brave and to do what is required. We all have a part to play. We're told that we're all members of one body, and as different members, we have different functions. In Genesis 45, 5-7 and 50, verse 20, Joseph knew, he came to know, he was elevated to save his family. Not for his own pat on his back of what he had accomplished. He recognized he was there to save God's people. Esther came to know she was elevated to save her people, God's people. Esther chapter 4, verse 14, and the subsequent passages, Esther chapter 5, 1-4. Queen Esther stands as an example to all, both men and women, of bravery to do what is required and to put one's trust in God. I know there are a lot more things that can be said about the book of Esther, but Queen Esther stands out for her loyalty, her bravery, her courage in the face of certain death, and being very clever in the way she went about herself. She held herself in honor. She acquitted herself as a godly person. If she had not been humble, if she was not a virgin, she would not have been there in the first place. We all have a part to play, and when it comes time for us to use those talents and abilities, we need to be brave and do them without reservation, as Esther did. If you're not a Christian this morning, you need to be. You're not serving God, but serving yourself. And you can change all of that. You can repent and be baptized and become a child of the King this very moment, this very hour. Why wait? Why not do it now? And if you are a Christian, not living the life that you should, perhaps living in timidity and fear, we're not called to serve God in timidity and fear. We're not called to serve God in cowardice, but in strength and in power and with honor. And if you are not living the way that you should, make it right with God now. And if you're subject to an invitation in any way, the waters of baptism, the prayers of the congregation on your behalf, come forward and let it be known now while we stand and while we sing.